Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. One of the luminaries of French cuisine died early this year. Paul Bocuse is credited with basically introducing American diners to French cuisine and then demystifying it. He also launched or mentored the careers of many American chefs, including Milwaukee's own Paul Bartolotta.
Bartolotta and food historian Kyle Cherik joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio to talk about Bocuse's legacy and why he was so important.
He had a discipline and a love of the craft. He called it le métier, the mestiere for the Italians, but the métier in French, and the love of the profession. You know, so often we look at people who work in restaurant businesses as, you know, this group of people who just sort of found a job in the restaurant and they ended up staying there. These were chefs in France who really changed food around the globe because he was the first true celebrity chef. You know, there were other famous chefs that made an impact on the evolution of French food. And when we talk about music, for example, the language of music is Italian, allegro and adagio. You know, the language of food is cuisine. It is mousse and souffle and julienne and all the culinary terms because they codified it. They created the language of food. Bocuse is the latest in this great run of four chefs, three prior to him, that really made a difference in developing French cuisine, but I think had an impact globally.
So some of the chefs before him, Escoffier?
Prior to Escoffier, you would have Carême, Antoine Carême. Mm-hmm. And then you had Auguste Escoffier. And then you had Fernand Point at La Pyramide in Vienne. And then as a young apprentice in those kitchens, you had guys like Bocuse and Toigrot and Alain Chappelle. And, you know, these guys who went on to define today's modern French cooking. And they all played a role in that evolution. Carême was probably the one who created, I don't know, haute cuisine as a like restaurant kind of food.
Yeah, grand cuisine was the term that they gave him for all the sauces and the everything. I mean, this is a kid that was abandoned in the streets, orphaned in the streets during the French Revolution, went on to be the most accomplished and famous chef of Napoleon's First Empire and cooked for Rothschilds and Russian royalty. So he was really the guy that everybody wanted to be like and died at 48. I mean, you think about Bocuse at 91 and what he accomplished, but, you know, cut that life in half. It's really incredible. So that's the standard, as Paul's talking about, this line starts with.
And then and then Escoffier, you know, was the person who really codified French cuisine. He's the one who basically wrote sort of the brigade system, you know, who was the saucier and who was the entremetier and who did each one of their jobs in the kitchen. So his job was that. And then he also codified it by standardizing many of the recipes that we know of today are all classics from Escoffier's book, for sure. You can have hollandaise sauce in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Melbourne, Australia, or Paris, France, and it will be hollandaise sauce.
Right. Well, and his book is over 1,000 recipes. I mean, it's not just for haute cuisine and fine cooking, though it definitely is, but we have it on our shelf, and we'll flip to it. It's pretty much that and Julia Child, and there's spots where you just, our kids laugh because with Julia Child, if you set the book down, it's either going to fall open to quiche or crepes. And with Escoffier, it's going to fall open to sauces or to roasts. And it's like, we still use them every day.
So, you know, you're talking about a very French thing, French food, French way of doing things, as you say, standardized. It has bled into all kinds of other cooking, though, hasn't it? These standards?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm Italian-American, born here in Milwaukee, moved to Italy, was in love with Italy. My whole goal was to elevate the stature of Italian food. And then I was at this one of the restaurants that was this two-star Michelin restaurant, and I was the chef de cuisine, and I felt like I kind of had peaked at that restaurant.
Which
and
is
I
a term
more.
From Escoffier, by the way, chef de cuisine. Yeah.
Right, chef de cuisine. Yeah. That's an Escoffier term, right? The chef, the actual cooking chef, the one who runs the kitchen day to day. And it was a two-star Michelin restaurant, and they were members of some very important food guides like the Relais Chateau and Tradition et Qualité. And so they literally took me to France because they knew that I was in love with regional Italian cooking, but they felt it would be a miss if they could assist me in having an experience working in these grand restaurants in France. And I went there deliberately not with a notebook to say I'm going to sit and write down recipes, but I came to absorb the professionalism, the mentality, the work ethic, the discipline, the precision. But I really compartmentalized my brain to say if I'm cooking French food, I'm going to think like a French person. But my soul, my heart is in Italy. And yet, so when I think about food, I really got to sort of turn off that brain, the French side of my brain. But I will say that there is certain techniques and disciplines and organizational structure that I learned in France that have proven to be invaluable. And that's translated to the way we organize our kitchens in our restaurants here in Milwaukee.
It's so interesting to me. And I don't know that this is true, but it's sort of my sense of it is that Italian cooking, and I'm talking fine Italian cooking, not necessarily just home cooking, seems to be looser, kind of like the music is. It's like there's a lot more room for improvisation. And French cooking is much more precise and maybe even a little fussy. And I wonder if that's true. Is that a fair thing to even kind of compare them that way?
Well, you're looking at me. I'm looking at you. I mean, I'll take it, but no, I'm going to...
Well, I'll give you an example. I'll give you a couple of examples. So I mentioned hollandaise sauce, right? Well, the beauty and the tragedy of Italy is that you can walk down the main street of Bologna called Via Indipendenza. It's the main, Independence Road in the center of Bologna. And there are, on both sides of the street, there's probably 20 restaurants on each side all the way up. And all of them make tortellini. And every one of those restaurants make the best, most authentic tortellini. And yet not two of them are the same. So while that is part of the individuality that is uniquely Italian, and I love that spirit of it, it's a head-scratcher when you try to define anything that's Italian because a lot of it has to do with what your personal tastes are. Do you like lots of mortadella in your tortellini? Do you like a lot of sausage? Do you like more prosciutto? Do you make it with only prosciutto? So it's like, you know, it's a head-scratcher. Hollandaise in Melbourne, Australia, Paris, France, or Milwaukee, Wisconsin will be hollandaise, full stop. Now, the French also had a point in their evolution, partly under Bocuse and guys like Roger Verger and Michel Gérard and these other guys. They were chefs who saw the need for an evolution, hence the movement Nouvelle Cuisine, which happened in the 70s and 80s. And I was working in France at that sort of pinnacle moment. So I was, by happenstance, by luck, I happened to be living in Italy when Italy was having a food and wine evolution revolution. And the same in France. So I kind of got a little taste of both the modern influence and the really staunch traditionalists in both of those countries.
Well, and I assume that serves you well here, both of those
influences. It kind of worked out.
Well, it does. I think what serves me well is that I have really, really amazingly talented chefs in the kitchens that allow me to play in the kitchens rather than sort of toil in them every single day. And in each one of our restaurants, we have chefs that have been with my brother and I for a very long time. And, you know, they do a lot of the heavy lifting. But I think that we have given them sort of the direction that we believe each of our concepts should go. We don't want to limit the personal creativity of our chefs. But there is a certain sort of organizational structure that we've set up in our restaurants so that they run that way. But it's really about our chefs.
I think Paul's being a little humble because he's one of only two chefs in the history of the James Beard to win it twice and other things. But he's precious for me, one, through the friendship, but two, because of his connection to people like Paul Bocuse. I mean, you know, I just had an idea and we'll bounce them back and forth. And I texted him shortly after the great chef died and he texted me back, I'm with the family, and then a list of basically every chef that's still living that I would like to meet, all in one room, and they were there to honor the great chef. And then basically, well, Bocuse had planned his funeral, so they were there to step in line and essentially say, we chef, even though it's posthumously, right? Yeah, and do as he had prescribed. But Paul trained and cooked with Bocuse, and he's got these great intimate stories about him lending a jacket or so on and so forth, where taking him through the market. And these are treasures. As a culinary historian, you don't get firsthand history. I can't talk to someone that worked with Escoffier. They're all gone, or Carême, or Lapointe, or so forth. I can talk to a chef that will tell me intimate stories about what it was like to be trained by someone that influenced pretty much everything on a Western plate right now.
So was he it was approachable?
It was. There's a big sign up on the wall in the kitchen. It said, silence en cuisine, silence in the kitchen. And it was crazy because in his kitchen, nobody talked. It was complete silence, except when he came in. And he would joke around and kid around with everybody. And I have to say, I love the world that we're in. I love being a chef. Paul Bocuse started some 30 years ago a sort of culinary Olympics in his name in his hometown of Lyon. And it's called the Bocuse d'Or, meaning the golden Bocuse statue. And they give three statues every year, gold, silver, bronze, just like in the Olympics. And it's sort of the Culinary Olympics. And I sit on as a culinary council member for Bocuse d'Or, which was founded by Thomas Keller, Jérôme Bocuse, his son, and Daniel Boulou. And they were charged by Mr. Paul to make sure that America got the representation. Paul Bocuse was injured in the resistance when he was in the resistance in the war. And he was taken to an American field hospital where he was given a blood transfusion, which saved his life. And from that day on, outside of Auberge, there's always two flags flying, the American flag and the French flag. And he will always say, there's American blood in my veins. I love America and I do everything for America. He was the first chef to come over to America to open at Epcot in the 80s when that was looked at. Oh, cooking at Epcot, what a sellout. You know, you're a three-star Michelin restaurant. And he said, no, you don't understand. America is ready for the next level. So in a way, you know, he was the Folgers precursor to Starbucks. Like, he understood at that moment to do that kind of food, which Americans were just getting prepared to. Mm-hmm. He didn't do the food that he cooked in Lyon because at Epcot it probably wouldn't have been appropriate. But he was the flag bearer of his country, but he was also, he saw the potential of America maybe in food before we saw it in ourselves.
And every chef that I've interviewed through the show and things like that made pilgrimages, sometimes kind of quietly, to Epcot to eat Paul and Jerome, his son's food. Yeah. Because this was like, you go and kiss the ring. I mean, I live in America. I don't have to get on a plane. I'm an idiot. Why wouldn't I go there? Because they've been cooking this great food, and then they'd go back in the kitchen and talk and so on and so forth. But, you know, when I first learned of this, I'm like, you went where? I'm like, oh, I'm the idiot, actually. Okay. Yeah. Some of the best French food in the country was happening in Epcot.
You know, we're talking about the effect that Monsieur Paul had on the world and also how he had an effect on restaurants here because of you. Going forward, what do you think his legacy is going to be in the kitchens of Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's just beginning. And what was interesting was, with all the modern information for the internet and such, a lot of the young kids, sadly, didn't know as much about these people as they probably should. I'm very pro the free-spirited chef who, you know, is a little bit the alchemist in the morning and comes in and looks around and grabs some stuff and starts whipping some, and every day it's a new dish. And I appreciate that. End of it. Our philosophy in our restaurants is a little bit different in that we think that the consumer today, more than ever, really wants to know as an educator. So there may be consumers out there who are interested in this alchemy, but there are also consumers who want to be taken on a journey. And the journey isn't just sort of the chef's craziness of the moment, but it's also dishes that have a storyline.
So I have to ask, is there a favorite Paul Bocuse dish that you would go back to? And Kyle, I'm going to ask you the same thing, but Paul Bertolotto, what do you think?
There are probably a couple of them,
okay.
And probably because they're the ones that I made. So we're doing his classic soupe de truffe that he made for the president of France in 1975, and it's been a signature of his restaurant ever since. So the soupe de truffe, for sure. The sole fin d'empoigne, obviously, another one. And then there was one in the early 2001, 2002, they were doing an event for Meals on Wheels in Rockefeller Center, New York, called La Crème de la Crème. And it was invited the top six or seven major French chefs. And each of us were given a chef that we were going to cook the food from. And Verger was there and Bocuse was there. And so I was given Bocuse. And so I immediately made this dish, which is the loup en croûte. It's the sea bass, the Mediterranean sea bass, loup de mer. And it's stuffed with lobster and black truffle. And it's cooked in puff pastry. And I did it because I knew it would be a big challenge for me personally. But I knew that if Mr. Paul came over to my booth that evening, that I wanted something that to show him that I not only did I learn this in your kitchen, but I got it. I got it. I could do it. And of course, he came over with Danielle to see my booth. And Danielle dragged him over. And he's like, oh, loup en croûte. And he's like, you know, there's like mille personnes, you know, it's like 1,000 people here. He said, you know, he said, are you you nuts? And I said, no. I said, I've got timers on each tray of whatever. And I showed him the whole system so that I didn't overcook the fish. And he said, okay, well, I said, let me taste, you know. And I made it for him. And he was really gracious. And he made me feel really good that we did something that honored the experience having worked for him. So probably Luang Krut. That would be my dish.
Okay. And you got it.
I like to think I did. Yeah. He made me feel good.
And Kyle, for you?
I would say I can't pronounce it correctly, but it is that chicken in the pig's bladder, because from a historical context, I love dishes that you can trace through. I mean, Paul's got this incredible raviolo dish that goes back to cooking for royalty and Italian royalty, and his mentor taught him how to do it, and he only makes it on special occasions. And the first time that I really ever ate his cooking, he made it, and he pulled me aside, and he said, this, like, forget everything else is happening, pay attention to this. And it changed my evening. And for Bocuse, it's, you know, so Carême was the first one to work in molecular gastronomy. We didn't call it that. He used pig bladders and he put it into what now we call sous vide, only then it was just hot water, but he kept it very low and bring the temp up and things like that. And now chefs are doing it in plastic bags and so on and so forth. But Bocuse, of course, knew that, and it had transferred through his mentors, and he improved the dish or the technique to this depth of flavor that is just sort of like you never had a chicken that tastes so good. You could never have a chicken that tastes so good. You should never even try to have a chicken that tastes so good. But it's that sort of historic where I can eat something and I get a thrill, where I can see the line going back through history and further beyond. And that gives me goosebumps. And then it tastes so good.
On
time.
Top of it,
well,
yeah.
We opted not to do it in the pig's bladder because I just didn't think we were quite ready for running around the dining room with pig's bladder. These
yeah, it's fair.
Spheres
it's
running
fair.
Around. I mean, that has a certain cachet in France. I looked at Adam and he goes, Paul, I can't do that. He said, love to do it, but he said, I don't think I can do that. And I said, I understand. He goes, but I'll make the same Morel cream sauce and I'll do a beautiful roast chicken and I'll marinate it the way we marinate it for the poulain. So it's an adaptation and adaptation of that dish that he's doing. And again, the Morel cream sauce is just, yeah. You know, it's not spa cuisine. I warn you now, but but it's just so unctuous and so full of flavor and so delicious and so moist.
Not everything has to be spa cuisine, you know. Not everything does.
It's okay to eat for pleasure and
absolutely.
Eat food that's rich and delicious. Yeah, you can get on the treadmill and you can live a healthy life, but I don't think we need to forego pleasure all the time.
Bocuse never did.
No. And he was 91.
Yeah.
And may we all live as
Bonnie.
Well and as long. Well, Paul Bartolotta and Kyle Cherik, it has been such a pleasure. And now I'm starving. So we better go out and have lunch. But I want to thank you both so much for
Delightful.
Coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for taking on such an interesting subject, because he's a remarkable man.
Paul Bartolotta is a Milwaukee chef and restaurateur behind restaurants that include Bacchus, Lake Park Bistro, and Ristorante Bartolotta. Kyle Cherik is a writer, host of Public Television's Wisconsin Foodie, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. They spoke with Bonnie North.